Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the June 30th and July 7th editions of People and Real Simple magazine. Some of these stories I will share today include Jackie, Jack, and Joan, Barbara's Private World, and Buckle Up for Brad Pitt. Jackie, Jack, and Joan. In 1956, JFK met fiery Joan Lundberg, and they embarked on a two-year affair with a shocking end, a bombshell new book reveals, by Liz McNeil. This is a People magazine exclusive. Joan Lundberg was one of a kind, says her son Zachary Hitchcock. She was unconventional and independent, a voluptuous beauty with a great smile. A spirited flight attendant with working-class roots, she married six times and died in 1982 at age 49 of cirrhosis of the liver. She left behind an unpublished memoir, Lovers Don't Snore, about her adventurous life, including an affair with John F. Kennedy in the late 1950s. It's a little-known chapter in the life of the 35th president, one that might have remained that way were it not for her family, who shared her unfinished manuscript with author J. Randy Taraborelli. He tells her story for the first time in a new biography, JFK, Public, Private, Secret, excerpted exclusively here. Joan was unique because she acted as JFK's therapist in many ways, says Taraborelli. In Jack's world, feelings were a liability and power was paramount. Joan got him to open up emotionally in a way he never did with Jackie, says Taraborelli. She was not connected to his circle, so he trusted she wouldn't say anything. As a result, the author says, he began to reckon with his flaws and ironically became a better husband. Toward the end of his life, Taraborelli notes, JFK confided in Joan Kennedy, his sister-in-law, that the way he had treated Jackie was painful, and he said, by painful, I mean shameful. He was trying to be a better man, and then his life is cut short. On August 19, 1956, the senator from Massachusetts met Joan Lundberg, 23, standing in front of the jukebox at the Sip and Surf, a dive bar in Santa Monica, California. "What are you going to play?" he asked her. "I was thinking Elvis Presley, but what would you like to hear?" she asked. He said he wanted to hear something so I can concentrate on you. Corny, but not bad. Joan, a single mom of two, was then living with a man named Norm Bishop and working as a flight attendant for Frontier Airlines and as a cocktail waitress on the side. When Jack asked where she lived, she told him it was in a trailer court close by, not hesitating. "What the hell's a trailer court?" he asked. She laughed and answered, "You don't want to know." After about 15 minutes, Jack, then 39, said goodbye and returned to his friends. Half an hour later, bar owner Pat Dorian called her to the phone. She picked it up. "How are ya?" came back the voice with its broad Bostonian accent. It was Jack. He was leaving town tomorrow for Italy, but would return in 2 weeks. On August 24th, Jack found out that Jackie, then 27, had given birth to their stillborn daughter, Arabella. 4 days later, he returned to Hammersmith Farm, her family's estate in Newport, Rhode Island, where she was recuperating and fed up. She'd always felt something was missing in his nature, and now she knew what it was, empathy. When Jackie wept at the breakfast table and said, "How could I have been so stupid?" her mother Janet reached out and took her hand. "You're not stupid," she told her. "You just put your trust in the wrong person." In early September, Jack returned to LA and invited Joan to a dinner party at the home of his sister Pat and her husband, actor Peter Lawford. Joan later remembered feeling insecure and out of her element, though she certainly looked stylish in an outfit from Jack's in Beverly Hills, a boutique favored by Marilyn Monroe. She would later write, "He lit up the room. People came over just to be near him, his energy magnetic. I thought, well, of course, that's the politician in him. But I soon realized that no, that's just who he is." At about midnight, Jack drove Joan up Pacific Coast Highway to a nondescript 1930s motor court called the Sunset Motel. They checked in as Mr. and Mrs. Robert Thompson. "The sex that night was wild," claimed Joan. The next morning, over breakfast, he unburdened himself. His fears, his insecurities. It was as if she was so removed from his circle, he could share anything. According to what Joan later recalled, Jack admitted that he and Jackie were the product of an arranged marriage, and as such marriages go, he said it was fine, not great, but okay. Jack said his family had turned against him for not being there for Jackie after Arabella's stillbirth. "He admitted that we Kennedys aren't the best at expressing emotion," Joan told him. "I'll bet that's the great excuse of your life." Joan asked him if he had grown to love his wife. He hesitated. "I don't know that I love anything," was his answer. "That can't be true," she said. After a moment, he added, "I love politics. I don't know how to love anything else." Jack Kennedy had no sooner walked into the foyer of Hammersmith Farm upon his return to Newport when Jackie hit him with a question. "Who's Trailer Park Joan?" As he collected his thoughts, she clarified things. "The divorcee, your sister, told me all about her." He explained that Joan was someone he had met in Los Angeles. Joan is vague in her unpublished memoir about how much Jack told Jackie, only that he told her pretty much everything. Within weeks, his father, Joe Kennedy, got a call from a top New York attorney who'd been retained to represent Jackie in a divorce. Joe met Jackie for lunch in New York to talk about it. Joe told Jackie that if she agreed to stay in the marriage, he could give her the freedom to do whatever she liked. He would offer her $100,000 upon the birth of her and Jack's first child. Jackie accepted the offer, but had to find a way to cope with her husband's infidelity. Many years later, Jackie told architect John Carl Warnecki, "He didn't have to lie to me about this Joan woman. I was already lying to myself." Warnecki recalled, "She told me things changed for her when Jack became involved with Joan, but that it wasn't a subject she wanted to get into. It was very painful, that much I knew. By 1957, JFK was being talked about as a presidential contender. In private, he continued his affair with Joan, flying her to meet him on different airlines and covering her expenses. She told me, "I never worry about trouble when I'm with Jack, because I pass for his sister Pat all the time," said Joan's sister Linda Lydon. Joan later recalled that she and Jack got along well, aside from normal lovers' tiffs between two high-spirited people. They often discussed his political career, with him starting off sentences with, "When I'm president, dot, dot, dot." One night in May 1957, Jack and Joan were sharing a cigarette in bed when he suddenly asked her, "Tell me the truth, Joan. Do you think Jackie is screwing other guys?" He explained that Jackie was so great, he couldn't imagine her not having someone else in her life. At the beginning of the year, he said, they'd started having sex now and again, but there's too much left unspoken between us. Recently, after having sex, she had asked him, "What you do with me in bed, is that what she likes?" Obviously meaning Joan. He could see the damage in her eyes, he said, and it killed me. After Jackie gave birth to Caroline on November 27th, Joan noticed a change. She later wrote, "I think I was now very much in love, and I was so mad at myself because I knew better. I knew better." While Jack and Joan would again share their bed in Minneapolis on April 25th and 26th, 1958, things were definitely different. On June 25th, according to her calendar, Joan called Jack. She was pregnant. Joan would recall that her news about the baby was like a knife to Jack's heart. While it was a shock, Joan wrote that they shouldn't have been so surprised. "I didn't like wearing a diaphragm, and Jack wouldn't wear rubber," she wrote. Jack couldn't help but wonder if Joan had purposely planned the pregnancy, given that she'd seen his devotion to Jackie after Caroline's birth. He also wondered if he was really the father, and Joan assured him he was. When he asked her how she felt about the pregnancy, she said she loved the two children she was raising on her own and knew she'd also love any child she and Jack brought into the world. He didn't know how to respond. "I have no words," he said. "Find some," she told him. He took both her hands in his own. "I'm so very sorry, Joan," he told her. "I am too," she said. Later that summer, they had a tense phone call. Sounding edgy and not like himself, he told her he decided she couldn't have the baby. Joan tried to argue, but she didn't know how. Jack said that he'd mail her $400. He told her, "You'll know what to do, Joan, please," he said, his tone desperate. "Being a politician is who I am," he told her. "Politics is all I know. If you take that away..." His voice trailed off. Before she could respond, he disconnected the line. A week later, she got an envelope with no return address. It was empty. She told him the money had been stolen. He became positively unhinged. Joan later wrote, "My God, you had never heard anybody use expletives so much in the whole history of Washington." Jack was very clear. He didn't want Joan to have the baby. He wired more money that same day, and she took care of things a day after that. She was angry and disappointed, but also realistic. From what she later told me, Mom realized the party was over, said Zachary Hitchcock in 2024. She couldn't be on the sidelines. The presidency, Jackie, the abortion, there was no way Mother could be marginalized in that way. She had too much pride. It ended not in person, but on the phone. When Jack called Joan to check on her, she told him, "I'm going to need to put some distance between us." He understood. "I owe you so much," he told her. "One thing I want to say to you, Kennedy," she told him. "You love Caroline, and I know that, but I'm somebody's daughter too. Remember that the next time you treat a woman the way you've treated me." On November 8, 1960, he became the 35th president. His relationship with Joan never came to light. But Jackie did install a spy, a woman she recommended for a job in the office of JFK's personal secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, to keep her posted of suspicious calls. From all available evidence, Jackie never found out about the abortion either. Many years later, she told a family member, "I was doing my best with the cards I'd been dealt. I loved Jack. I know he loved me. I had to ignore the rest of it. My marriage was like a deep black hole, and I knew if I looked down, I'd fall in." Kennedy had a telling conversation with his friend Florida Senator George Smathers in early 1962. "Do you worry Jackie will find out about the other women?" George asked. Jack became instantly frustrated. "There are no other women. I've never told any other woman I love her. There is only Jackie. Besides," he said, "we could all be blown up in an atomic war tomorrow. That's what worries me, not this bullshit." After their son Patrick died on August 9, 1963, 2 days after being born prematurely, Jackie decided to travel with her husband to Dallas that November. A couple of months earlier, at the celebration of their 10th wedding anniversary, Jackie and Jack gave each other gifts. She presented him with a new St. Christopher's medal because he'd placed his own in Patrick's coffin. In turn, he gave her a gold and emerald ring, which represented the fighting spirit of the Irish he'd seen in their son's fight for survival. He slipped it onto Jackie's finger next to her wedding band and asked her to marry him. There had never been a real proposal, except for a few words in an airport when she returned from her trip to England in 1953. Jack was a different man. They planned a private ceremony to renew their vows for September 1964 at Hammersmith, marking their 11th wedding anniversary. Jackie planned to wear a pale blue or yellow dress, but it never came to pass. Joan, who had married Fremont Hitchcock in 1963, was devastated by the assassination. She wrote, "When the truth struck home, I closed my bedroom curtains and shades, and I cried, screamed, and cursed alone for hours." JFK's dangerous liaisons. Inga Arved, the Danish journalist in 1944 with JFK, was his first love, but his father forced him to end it when she was suspected of being a Nazi spy. She was later exonerated. Gunilla von Post. They met on the French Riviera in 1953, a month before he married Jackie. In 1955, he visited her in Sweden. She later wrote a book about their affair, Love, Jack. Judith Exner, introduced to JFK by Frank Sinatra in 1960 in Las Vegas, Exner arranged clandestine meetings between the president and mob boss Sam Giancana. Marilyn Monroe. Jackie didn't know the details, but suspected something, says Tara Borelli. She told her husband, "This one's different, Jack. This one worries me." Mary Pinchot Meyer. The Washington socialite was a frequent White House guest from 1961 to 1963. She was mysteriously murdered in 1964. The case was never solved. You've been listening to Jackie, Jack, and Joan, a People magazine exclusive. Barbara's Private World. The beloved entertainer on finding joy as grandma and why she's not ready to say goodbye to singing 70 years into her career. By Rachel DeSantis from People magazine. It's just after 2 p.m. Los Angeles time when Barbara Streisand answers the phone, but the legendary star's day is just beginning. "We go to bed very late, so I'm still in bed," Streisand, 83, says of her routine with husband James Brolin, 84. "We have a different schedule. We love the silence of the night." The EGOT-winning singer, actress, and director's life has long been built around sound, first through her music and movies, these days more through the giggles of her grandkids. So it's understandable why Streisand would appreciate some peace and quiet. In the year and a half since releasing her best-selling memoir, My Name is Barbara, Streisand has stepped back from the spotlight, focusing instead on her family. She is mom to son Jason Gould, 58, with ex-husband Elliot Gould, and grandmother to stepson Josh Brolin's four children, Trevor, 37, Eden, 32, Westland, 6, and Chapel, 4. "I asked my daughter-in-law, Catherine, to bring the children over and take some pictures with me. The joy that I was feeling whenever they come over, it's just joyous," she says. "It's wonderful to have family. That's how the Secret of Life title came. The secret is several things, but one of them is family." Streisand is referring to The Secret of Life, Partners, Volume 2, her first new studio album in 7 years, which features duets with Bob Dylan, Tim McGraw, and more. She says Paul McCartney, with whom she sings his romantic ballad, My Valentine, was the first one on board. He's a no-brainer. "They were all so special. I hadn't sung in a very long time, so I didn't know if I had a voice left," she says, noting that the extensive recording process for the Grammy-nominated audiobook of her memoir left her voice hoarse. The project, a follow-up to 2014's Partners, is just the latest highlight for the star, whose career began at the tender age of 13. Lucky 13 is also, coincidentally, the subject of Letter to My 13-Year-Old Self, her new duet with Gen Z jazz pop phenom Lofi. Looking back on that time in her life, Streisand offers sage advice. "I would tell her, believe in yourself, believe in your choices, believe in what you hear, what you feel. I did it instinctively. Listening to her gut has served her well. After releasing her debut album in 1963, she went on to become one of the most decorated stars of all time, winning 2 Oscars and 10 Grammys. Despite her decades of fame, Streisand says she's still surprised by the amount of interest people have in her personal life. A recent interview made headlines after Streisand insisted she didn't remember whether she'd slept with Warren Beatty, an anecdote that's featured in her memoir. "I always kind of avoided publicity because they got so many things wrong," she says. "In the early years of my career, it was ridiculous. I never liked being misunderstood." It would be understandable for the star to want to say goodbye to public life for good. But Streisand says all of the wonderful people who performed with her on the new album were catalysts for her return to the studio. And she's not done yet. Does she have another album in her? God, yeah. As long as I have a voice, I love the privacy of recording, she says. "I love standing there in front of the mic and the music in my ears and singing. When I was 18 years old, I made my mother call up publishers to get free music. I still have that person inside, that kid. There are more songs I want to sing." Her A-list duet partners. For The Secret of Life Partners, Volume 2, Streisand recruited an impressive roster of collaborators, including Ariana Grande, Lofi, Paul McCartney, and Mariah Carey. "It was fun," she says, of recording the LP, due out June 27th. Love, marriage, and grandkids. Streisand spends her downtime with her family, including granddaughter Weslin. Life partners. Streisand and husband James Brolin began dating in 1996 and will celebrate their 27th wedding anniversary on July 1st. This has been Barbara's Private World from People Magazine. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. First person, Ticket to Ride. An actor, author, and mom of 3 resisted the lifelong desire to get herself a motorcycle, rev her engine, and follow her path forward, until she realized that the only person she needed permission from was herself. By Diane Farr from Real Simple Magazine. "For decades, I got on the back of a motorcycle with anyone who would take me for a ride. I don't like roller coasters, race cars, or speedboats, but moving through the air like a turtle outside its shell on a motorized bike does it for me. It might be the only activity I've ever been completely present for. Maybe because the risk is so great, which is also what kept me on the back as a passenger, believing I couldn't handle a 500-pound machine on my own. Then I got engaged at age 35, and my fiancé proposed a solution, a Vespa. Same wind in my face, same commitment to the moment, but so much lighter, and in turn, so much easier to control. We planned to buy one just after our wedding, only to discover on our honeymoon that I was already pregnant. This brought my two-wheeled dreams to a halt. Fewer than 1 in 5 motorbike owners are female, and I didn't know one who was also a mother, so it never occurred to me I could be both. 15 years later, a Vespa appeared in my driveway. My kids were older, and my husband hoped that more joy in my life would save our marriage. By then, I'd begun wondering where I'd lost myself in the beautiful chaos of raising a family. A Vespa might hold the key, but it still required a motorcycle license. So I took weekend classes where I drove in circles around a parking lot on the Harley available to students. Riding it felt better than I'd imagined, and certainly more fun than the circles I'd been making in a minivan at school drop-off. 3 days of classes and a state driving test earned me a permit and the chance to drive beyond the lot. While my pretty scooter seemed like a gentle gateway to my moto dreams, Los Angeles is not the Amalfi Coast. I soon realized that a motorcycle, with its loud and fast engine, would actually be safer for me. I could rev a bike's throttle to alert other drivers that I was beside them, plus get out of danger quicker than a larger, more powerful engine. So despite my driving teacher's warning not to buy a monster machine, I got myself an 800cc Ducati racing bike. Not because it was fast, rather because it was about 100 pounds lighter than many motorcycles on the market. It seemed more realistic for me. I would just drive it at an appropriate speed. Still, it was heavy. I wasn't strong enough to pick it up when I dropped it, and I dropped it many times that first year. It never took long for pedestrians, cops, even one time my kid's babysitter, to help right the machine so I could call a tow truck for the broken hand brake or foot pedal and begin again. Nothing but my confidence was injured, as these were not crashes. The bike would just lay itself down when I stopped at a traffic light, started up again at a stop sign on a hill, or, more than once, turned across two lanes of city traffic. These events elicited screams from other motorists worried for me. They also gave rise to my suspicion that I still shouldn't be riding a motorcycle, that it was too much, or I was. A midlife crisis is typically defined as a period of emotional turmoil and introspection between ages 40 and 60, characterized by feeling unfulfilled, questioning life choices, and engaging in risky or impulsive behaviors. All of the above can also describe women suffering from postpartum depression or going through a divorce. Possibly it's just the definition of being female. How could I tell if I was having a midlife crisis or had simply, like so many women, denied myself permission to be a whole human while focusing on keeping other small humans alive? I was taking action to live in a way that felt truer to who I was, but I was stumbling mightily, both literally and figuratively. I started to feel stuck in my own head and doubt myself on the bike, which anyone who's driven a motorcycle can tell you is a recipe for disaster. I needed to think this all through if I wanted to stop falling down. I got off the streets and into therapy, where it became clear that leaving a marriage and returning to full-time work, plus riding a motorcycle, meant claiming more agency than I thought I was allowed. So the question became, was the motorcycle about being authentic to myself, or was I self-sabotaging to stop moving forward on a path that scared me? According to the couple's therapist, I was also seeing weekly with my soon-to-be ex-husband, my bike riding was not self-harming behavior. In her 20 years of practice, she had found that most women will curtail their own strength to survive in a family system, silencing themselves for the comfort of the group. She believed that, more than a person's age or a difficult life transition, leaving this tendency unchecked causes depression, mood swings, self-doubt, and emotional outbursts. I could see now that I kept dropping the bike because I was going too slowly. Without momentum, it would keel over, like my dreams of self-actualization. These metaphors really just write themselves. On my 8th trip in the passenger seat of a tow truck, after I had dropped the bike due to moving way too slowly as I approached a gas pump, with the engine off and my feet merely pedaling, I realized I was still looking for permission. Not from the attendant helping me pick it back up, or my ex, or my therapist, or my kids, or society. I was looking for permission from myself about what I was allowed to be as a middle-aged woman. Permission to get strong and move forward, sometimes with my family and sometimes alone. I sold the Vespa and used the money to hire a trainer. My plan was to do strength training so I could keep the Ducati upright, but it turned out that this wasn't necessary. I already was strong enough because as soon as I committed myself to becoming a motorcycle rider, and before I had a single session at the gym, I stopped dropping the bike. In fact, I never dropped it again. I'm now 55. I was recently lane splitting on the freeway while being safe and fully present when I saw my old minivan up ahead. Behind the wheel was my oldest child, who had just gotten his license. Thrilled, I caught up to him and revved my engine to say hello. I'm not sure whose smile was bigger. This has been Ticket to Ride by Diane Farr from Real Simple Magazine. Pets, creature comforts. Man's best friend can truly help us through the hard times. Here, three inspiring stories about the dogs whose emotional support meant everything to their humans. By Kristen Kusek Lewis. This is from Real Simple. The German Shepherd mixes who offer a reset. As a palliative care clinical therapist just outside Washington, D.C., Chris Van Houten supports patients who are facing the end of their lives. Each day is different, she says. But mostly, I create a safe space for people and their families to process their feelings. I listen to their life stories and help them cope. Often she sits with families as they keep vigil for their dying loved ones. I join in their laughter, share memories, and learn what brings them joy, she says. It's rewarding, but heart-rending work. So at the end of the day, she seeks out the comfort of Max and Luna, her two German Shepherd mixes, ages 4 and 7. Coming home to them means unconditional love and lots of kisses, she says. It also eases her into a state of mindfulness. As I'm petting the dogs after work, watching how they show excitement and gratitude effortlessly, my thoughts begin to focus, my breathing slows, and I focus my attention on their reactions. Is this the right spot? Should I scratch over here? Spending time with them each night resets Chris for the following day, helping her feel renewed and ready to be there for her patients. The pup who made adjusting to a new life easier. In 2004, Katie Clay moved to New York City with her then-boyfriend Jordan to start their post-college lives together. Then Jordan confessed he wanted to quit his finance job and join the Marine Corps. He had mentioned this desire years earlier, but Katie never really thought it would happen. Now she worried about the drastic change it would bring. He started training, they got engaged, and in 2007, he was assigned to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Katie joked that if she was going to move, she was getting a dog. 1 month before their wedding, they relocated to tiny Surf City, a quiet town on the Carolina coast that basically shuts down during the winter. 2 months later, just 1 week before Jordan was deployed to the Middle East for the first time, they picked up Hank, a 14-pound Newfoundland pup. I look back on that chapter of my life with such reverence. To be jumping headfirst into a new life, making such bold, brave decisions, Katie says. I honestly don't think I could have done any of it without Hank. I didn't know a soul, but with my wild puppy at my side, I didn't feel alone and slowly fell in love with my new life. The pair explored their new town and walked the beach every morning. Not only was Hank a great wingman for meeting new people, he was also a hilarious, very strong distraction. He once pulled a huge bench through a bank drive-thru in front of all the shocked bank tellers, Katie says. While Hank sadly crossed the Rainbow Bridge almost 9 years ago, Katie still thinks of him whenever she's lonely. He was my best friend and didn't leave my side through 2 deployments or for the rest of his remaining years. The foster dogs who can brighten dark days. Allie Kirkpatrick can't afford to have an off day. She is a busy mom of 3 kids under 8, and the owner of Old Town Books, an independent bookstore in Alexandria, Virginia. She also experiences seasonal affective disorder, suffering from low moods, feelings of hopelessness, and a lack of energy during the long, dark days, which is not conducive to running a business and raising a family. I tried everything, she says. Light therapy, fish oil, medication. Apparently, what I needed was puppies. Allow us to back up for a moment. Last summer, her longtime dog, Scout, passed away. He was a fixture at the shop and a friend to everyone who came in, she says. Losing him was terribly hard. I wasn't ready to adopt, and instead started fostering dogs, which helped me grieve. There was an urgent call for help after Hurricane Helene hit in September 2024, and Allie rose to the challenge. Then, this past winter, a special set of fosters changed Allie's life in a way she never saw coming. Just before Christmas Eve, she began fostering Poetry, a 2-year-old mama, and her 6 puppies. After a few days, I joked to the other volunteers, "I think they're curing my seasonal affective disorder," she says. But then I realized it was true. Puppies are so in the moment, it's hard to feel blue when you're holding one. They're so much work, but also offer so much joy. Allie says fostering the litter with their mother also helped her connect with her kids. After 8 weeks, with winter nearly over, the dogs all went home to their new adoptive families. While she thought about keeping one, She realized that by not adopting a dog, she'd have more bandwidth to take in new fosters. "We miss our house guests," she says, "but they gave us so much, including a path to happiness, even in the winter, with a steady stream of puppies." This has been Creature Comforts from Real Simple Magazine. Inside F1. Buckle up for Brad Pitt. The Oscar winner takes on the wild world of Formula One race car driving in A Cinematic Thrill Ride by Julia Moore from People. Brad Pitt has wanted to put the pedal to the metal on the big screen for about as long as he's been acting. "I've been trying to get in, do a racing film for literally decades," he recently told reporters. "And whether it was on bikes or whether it was in cars, for whatever reason, it just didn't pan out." Until now, Pitt, 61, stars in director Joseph Kosinski's F1 the Movie, an ambitious drama set in the high-stakes world of Formula One race car driving, an elite team sport where the costs of the cars and the speeds they reach are both exceptionally high. To make the project that he calls the most authentic racing film that's ever been done, Kosinski enlisted 7-time Formula One world champion Lewis Hamilton, 40, who signed on as a producer and appears in the film as himself in a brief cameo. "I had to talk him into it," Kosinski says. The story centers on Pitt's Sonny Hayes, a washed-up former Formula One driver who could have been the best in the world had a life-changing accident not left him on the brink of death decades prior. His old friend and former teammate, Ruben Cervantes, Javier Bardem, now a businessman, tracks Sonny down and recruits him to join his struggling Formula One team and race with hotshot rookie Joshua Pierce. British actor Damson Idris, whose name has been floated as the next Black Panther. The two drivers instantly clash. Cocky JP, as Sonny dubs him, is skeptical of Sonny's unconventional approach to the sport, while Sonny doesn't like his teammate's attitude. Their rivalry keeps Kate, Carrie Condon, the team's technical director and Sonny's crush, on her toes as she does everything she can to keep them, well, on track. With scenes set at real Formula One races in Las Vegas, Mexico City, Abu Dhabi, Mogi Road, Hungary, and more locations. "We were really spoiled," Pitt tells People. "The pressure was on to film as quickly as possible. We'd have like 5 to 10 minutes to get something," Idris recalls, "and we've got a real crowd there and a real race is happening." Remembers Condon, 42, "It wasn't all fun and games." Sin City proved to be the most challenging place to film. It's a street track. It's only up for a few nights out of the year. We had one 15-minute slot in the middle of the night to shoot with Brad, Kosinski recalls. "It's pretty intense. Not to mention dangerous. It was cold, so the tires didn't have a lot of grip," he continues. "That was an intense scene, and Brad really brought it. It's especially impressive because, as Condon notes, Pitt and Idris were pulling double duty. They kind of had two jobs, the driving and the acting." 4 months of training led to that moment. Pitt and Idris practiced in simulators and spent hours driving in sports cars before moving on to actual race cars, all under the watchful eyes of stunt drivers Luciano Bacchetta and Craig Dolby. Though he was a novice, Pitt had a quick feel for the car, thanks to his many years riding motorcycles, says Kucinski. Even pro racer Hamilton tipped his helmet to Pitt. Lewis was really impressed that Brad had that talent right out of the gate, says Kucinski. Idris found his co-star's natural skill intimidating and inspiring all at once. I was watching him all the time. Brad was so good, he says, adding that he and his co-star both had so much fun while they were behind the wheel. Especially Pitt, and that was evident to pretty much everyone on set. We had to tear him out of the car, Kucinski remembers. The saddest day for Brad was when we said, "It's a wrap." He just loved it. Indeed, the star would like nothing more than to climb back in the driver's seat. As he told reporters at a recent F1 event, "I almost wish we could shoot it again." F2, anyone? With reporting by Nicole Acosta and Tommy McArdle. Brad and Inez's big date night. Pitt and his girlfriend, Inez de Ramon, made a rare public appearance together when they hit the red carpet for the F1 premiere in New York City's Times Square on June 16th. He's been dating the jewelry company executive, 35, since 2022. Pitt loved having Inez by his side, a source says. She's no drama, very supportive, and they're doing very well. Pitt's crew. Damson Idris as Joshua Pierce. "We couldn't stand each other," the Snowfall actor jokes of Pitt, with whom he clashes in the movie. Carrie Condon as Kate McKenna. The Irish Oscar nominee's character reluctantly mixes business with pleasure when she falls for Pitt's Sonny. Kim Bodnia as Casper Smolinski. The Danish actor said his character, the team principal, connects with Pitt's Sonny and his fighting spirit. Javier Bardem as Ruben Cervantes. Though he plays Pitt's pal in the movie, Bardem was a bit starstruck. "It's Brad Pitt," he remembers thinking. Why Simone Ashley's role was cut. The Bridgerton star's casting in the film was revealed in July 2024, and she was rumored to play a love interest for Idris, with whom she filmed at Formula One events last year. Ashley, 30, called the film one of the craziest things I think I've ever been a part of. But her role was largely cut from the movie's final version. "It happens on every film, where you have to shoot more than you can use," director Kucinski explains. "There were two or three storylines that ultimately didn't make it into the final cut. But Simone, she's an incredible talent, incredible actress, incredible singer, and I would love to work with her again." This has been Inside F1, Buckle Up for Brad Pitt, from People. One last thing. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the star 77, returns for season 2 of Netflix's FUBAR. "Last time my pets made me laugh. I have to feed them in a certain sequence. So the dogs sit there, and the pig sits there, and they're waiting for a crumb to fall to see who can get it first. This morning I spilled some, and the pig just inhaled it. His neck is so thick, he had to sit down to look up at me like, "I know that was an accident, but let's have some more." Last obsession. Probably chess. One friend of mine in Budapest looked it up, and apparently we've played 5,000 games in the last 5 years. The language we use is funny. I just write to one of them and say, "Move." That means, "Let's play." Last thing I took from a set. I have a lot of memorabilia. Jim Cameron gave me the airplane they used in True Lies as a model. I have my Mr. Freeze costume from Batman and Robin. Then I have Terminator 1 and Terminator 2, the skeleton. My whole office is filled. Last time I was moved to tears. I do cry sometimes, like if I see a scene of a funeral, or if I hear something very patriotic, like an anthem. It's really kind of touching. Last time I sang out loud. I wouldn't torture anybody. I don't even sing by myself in the car. I'd rather not destroy what I'm listening to with my voice. The only time I might is if it's midnight and I want any guests to leave. With reporting by Julie Jordan, this is one last thing from People. That will wrap today's Women's Hour. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the stories today and will make plans to join us again next week for another entertaining collection of women's magazine articles. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream as well as have access to shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Have a great day, and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.